Next case is number 07501, Leonel Centers against the United States. Mr. Gray.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Mr. Centers found himself in the unusual position because of collateral litigation, seeking to get a supplemental insurance claim paid better part of a decade after the original insurance claim had been put in. The issues before this court relate to the various defenses that the government has raised in attempting to avoid that claim. There were two that the Court of Federal Claims accepted, and on the basis of which the court dismissed Mr. Centers' claim.
At one point, Mr. Centers sued Centennial and Mr. Kane to try and require them to go after the supplemental insurance.
That's correct.
And in the Seventh Circuit, he makes a clear indication that the reason he's doing this is because he doesn't have privity of contract to go after himself. Right? Why isn't that somewhat binding on what the Court of Federal Claims later agreed, that he didn't have privity of contract?
Well, Your Honor, that defense has not been raised. B, I don't think that there was a concession that he lacked privity in the sense of having a jurisdictional basis. Clearly, Mr. Centers pursued that litigation because he
couldn't do it himself. He had to have them do it.
Well, he was concerned that he couldn't do it himself. And he chose to require Centennial to do it with him. And the Seventh Circuit, of course, had the final word on that. And there's no question on that. But when we start here, in terms of whether privity is required, that issue was really disposed of by this court's decision in Insurance Company of the West. And I find it somewhat amazing, frankly, that the Court of Federal Claims said that this court really didn't mean what it said in Insurance Company of the West. That if you are the assignee of someone who is in privity with government, then you have satisfy the requirements of the Tucker Act.
Is he an assignee or he has a chosen action? Is that the same thing as being the assignee?
Well, he has a chosen action that was assigned to him, Your Honor. I don't know what he could be other than an assignee.
That's the question, of course. And beyond that question, of course, we have to ask whether under the HUD regulations, HUD had consented to Mr. Centers stepping into the position of Centennial. And that seems to be required as well, doesn't it?
Well, Your Honor,
there would be privity.
The two things you say, there's a question about whether HUD consented. Factually, there's no question that HUD didn't consent. That's undisputed.
Is it required?
No, Your Honor. Because for a couple of reasons. First of all, the HUD regulations, even were they perceived to be binding, only deal with an executory insurance contract. And by the time the assignment is made in this case, the executory insurance contract is long gone. It was disposed of in 1992 when the claim was processed and the mortgage note was turned into HUD. So there is no more executory insurance contract to be concerned about. All there was a claim for additional payments. That's first and foremost, and the language of the regs all speaks in that regard in terms of the endorsement on the note and warning people that might buy the note. Well, there was no danger of any other party buying the note because HUD had held it since 1992, and the assignment and issue here was made in the year 2000. Second of all, the HUD regulations are simply invalid. And they're invalid because they're trumped by the statute. Congress, in this provision of the National Housing Act, which is section 232, dealing with nursing homes, adopted various provisions of section 207, which is another insurance program. and they adopted the provision that deals with payment of claims and says that you pay a mortgagee. Now, if you go to Section 207 of the National Housing Act, it defines mortgagee in statutory language, and it says that the mortgagee is the original mortgagee or an assign.
But there's nothing there that says HUD may not require a consent procedure to validate an assignment.
That's true, Your Honor. But Congress...
There's nothing explicit. Why wouldn't HUD have the authority to say, we're going to approve these before they become valid in our eyes?
Because if you look at the National Housing Act insurance...
I see why they do that. I mean, that in theory, you could assign it to someone who's totally insolvent and totally... that the government doesn't want to deal with for some reason.
Yes, Your Honor. Although that underscores the point I just made about it. They really are concerned about the executory insurance contract. That HUD has an interest in who its mortgagee...
But it could be just somebody they don't want to deal with, someone they've disbarred from all contact with HUD. They're for past conduct. They may have a reason for not wanting an assignment, but for not acknowledging an assignment. Is there anything in the statute that forbids them from having that concern?
Well, the point, Your Honor, is that the statute implicitly does so, because the Congress has seen fit in a variety of the programs under the National Housing Act to say that assignees must be approved by HUD, by the Secretary. But they did not do that here. And in fact, as pointed out in our supplemental brief, if you look at another provision of this Section 232 with nursing homes, the separate part that deals with fire protection programs, they did talk about HUD approval there. So Congress has shown that it knows how to specify HUD approval when it wants to, and it didn't here. So what you've got is HUD saying, well, for many years, we've required by regulation that we approve, and you didn't do it here, and that's the end of the matter. And it really doesn't matter what Congress said, because we, after all, are HUD. The other argument that the Court of Federal Claims accepted is the one under the anti-assignment.
But that was not the conclusion that they reached.
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. The Court of Federal Claims concluded that the subject matter jurisdiction relied on privilege, not on the anti-assignment.
That
is a discussion of the anti-assignment act, but the conclusion itself of the court below relies totally on privity.
I think that's a fair analysis, Your Honor. I would agree with that.
How do we establish privity?
Through Insurance Company of the West. Because in Insurance Company of the West, the court has said that the Tucker Act, I'm quoting now, the Tucker Act must be read to waive sovereign immunity for assignees, as well as those holding the original claim, except as barred by a statutory provision such as the Anti-Assignment Act.
So you're going back to common law that an assignee would stand in the shoes of the assignor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that mean that the Tucker Act then waives sovereign immunity for the assignee as well?
Yes, I believe that that's what it means, Your Honor. And then you reach the question of the Anti-Assignment Act.
Do we need to get there?
Well, unless the court is going to disavow Insurance Company of the West, it seems to me that you have to get there.
Is there a difference between subrogation and assignment? Subrogation being the apparent subject of the Insurance Company of the West.
Well, there's no question that subrogation was the actual issue before the court in the Insurance Company of the West. But the language and the reasoning that the court used was broader. It didn't say simply that subrogates can claim under the Tucker Act. It said, in the language I've just read, that all assignees can. Now, it then noted carefully that the Anti-Assignment Act might still have to be dealt with, that was a separate issue.
Is that your understanding, that this was not a decision by the Court of Federal Claims with respect to the Anti-Assignment Act? You certainly stated an attitude with respect to the applicability of that act?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it's dictum, which is where the government is attempting to go. And we've cited cases in our reply brief, one from the Supreme Court, that says clearly and explicitly that when that the rationale that the court uses in reaching its decision is part of its whole. And that is what we have here. It's not simply dictum. It was a clear statement of how the court got to its result. It was dealing with the subrogate, but its rationale was in terms of all passing means.
Okay. Let's hear from the other side.
May it please the court that this court should affirm the decision of the Court of Federal Claims. First, let me state the matter was decided on a motion to dismiss pursuant to 12b1, and the facts largely in the facts in the complaint were taken as undisputed. These facts were supplemented by the parties in a joint submission, which is included in the joint appendix. Analytically, there's a distinction between restrictions upon the assignment of contracts and the restrictions that exist upon assignment of claims. And the Court of Federal Claims in this case properly addressed both situations. The case that exists here involves the allegations by Mr. Senders that that a chosen action was transferred to him in the year 2000. In fact, according to the allegations in the complaint, payment was not made in connection with the dispute that rose between Sentinel and Mr. Blumenfeld.
We don't really know. Payment was made. This could have been a factor in the overall conditions of the transaction.
Well, the parties, consistent with the practice in the 12b1 motion, the parties, the court took as correct specific allegations of fact in the complaint. What the government did was supplemented those facts with a couple of brief documents. There has been no discovery. So the matter was decided based upon the undisputed allegations in the complaint as supplemented by certain documents the government offered, which had the effect of fleshing out what the transaction occurred.
Should that be treated as Rule 56 then?
No, because parties may submit documents in support of a Rule 12b1 motion. The question goes to the court's jurisdiction, and the court has the burden to determine its jurisdiction without going further. And the submission of additional documents are properly considered by a court in entertaining a motion pursuant to 12b1. So the court properly considered the motion pursuant to 12b1, and the government having raised the issue of jurisdiction, it was incumbent upon Mr. Senders to show by preponderance of the evidence that in fact the court had that jurisdiction. The Court of Federal Claims properly held that he did not. Analytically, what makes the case somewhat more difficult to consider is the fact that there's a distinction between assignment of claims and assignment of contracts. The first portion of the court's opinion addresses the question of privity, and privity refers to the existence, goes to the question of contract. And the first portion of the court's decision talks to and addresses the ability of Mr. Senders to claim in some manner that this entire contract has been transferred to him. Now, that wasn't the allegation in the complaint. The allegation in the complaint is that there's simply a transfer of a chosen action. The privity is significant in this case, however, because according to Mr. Senders' allegation, payment wasn't made in accordance with this obligation until 2003. In other words, Sentinel went ahead and made a claim to HUD for this additional money that it incurred as a result of the dispute concerning Mr. Blumenthal. But in fact, it made no payment on that. So Sentinel and the government, if you would, were still involved in submissions and negotiations of this matter. And this finally led to Sentinel submitting a claim to the government documenting the fact that it actually paid out additional money, the money under dispute in this case. Significantly, however, that occurred after the alleged transfer from Sentinel Corporation to Mr. Senders in this case. So essentially, Sentinel and the government were still in a contractual situation. Counsel has stated that the contractual situation ended upon the submission of the claim. Well, that in a way is fatal to their contention, because the government's contention is in this case that the government's only obligation, it was one and only obligation, that is you submit a claim, you get paid and you're done. The government made its payment, and the statute of limitations bars the case because the government paid the claim and you didn't appeal it. Mr. Center's contention in this case is that there's some sort of continuing contractual relationship between HUD and Sentinel and Mr. Center's in some manner that obligated the government to consider a supplemental insurance claim. Our point, and the point we raise in urging affirmance on the basis of the statute of limitations, is there is no such, Mr. Center's never alleged any such contractual relationship. His concession here that the relationship between HUD and Sentinel ended when the payment was originally made in 1993 establishes the fact that the statute of limitations is run on this case, establishes that as a matter of fact. If the contractual relationship ended between the parties in 1993, as I understand the comments here today, the statute of limitations clearly bars this case. What the Court of Federal Claims did was it accepted Mr. Center's contention in his papers that there was some sort of contractual relationship. In the government's view, the contractual relationship ended in
1993. That's not an issue before us, is it?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, because we've argued as an alternative basis for affirmance that the court should hold that the case is barred by the statute of limitations. Although the trial court specifically rejected this, this is an argument made in advance of support of the judgment below, and we may properly rely on any argument that's properly supported by the record below, and in this case, the record below supports application of the statute of limitations. Unlike the case upon which the Court of Federal Claims relied, Turchling versus the United States, and upon which Mr. Centers relied, the contractual relationship here ended in 1993 when HUD proffered payment.
We had no findings on that. And how can we decide on that basis?
Because, Your Honor, in a motion to dismiss, you take the allegations in the complaint as supplemented by any documents, and it is Mr. Center's obligation to show by preponderance of the evidence that the court has jurisdiction.
What about the state court case?
The state court case, if anything, confirms the fact that the relationship between HUD and Sentinel ended. The HUD...
That isn't what it seemed to say.
Well, Your Honor, the HUD's obligation under the terms of the endorsement of the note which specifically required that the party seeking payment present to HUD all its evidence of entitlement. That was done in 1990 and payment was made in 1993. All the obligations and requirements under the contract were met at that point in time. Mr. Center's arguments to the Court of Federal Claims, and the Court of Federal Claims holding, presuming that the statute of limitations did not bar this action, presumes the existence of some contractual obligation of the United States to entertain supplemental application for insurance benefits. There is no such right. The regulations which define the contract in this case were very clear. You have to put in all the paperwork, you have to put it in 30 days, HUD will rule on that and pay you. It was incumbent upon Mr. Centers, if he didn't like that resolution, to sue in 1993. Now what makes the case, I think, more difficult analytically is the distinction which courts have drawn between the assignment of claims and the assignment of contracts.
But Mr. Centers did not own the shows in action in 1993.
Absolutely. So any right... Exactly. Sentinel had the obligation in 1993, if they didn't like the resolution, to sue at that point in time. And the contention, as I understood the comments earlier, to concede the fact that the contractual relationship between the United States and HUD ended in 1993 when payment was made. We agree with that proposition. And it's that very reason the statute of limitation bars any claim.
To get back to where the Court of Federal Claims decided the case, what about insurance company otherwise?
Well, the Court of Federal Claims didn't decide the case. They addressed the question of privity, but they didn't decide the case upon the basis of privity. What they decided the case upon was the question of assignment of claims. Now, the Tucker Act provides an individual...
What about the conclusion, Mr. Groner, of the Court of Federal Claims?
Well...
He said that because the plaintiff was not in privity of contract with the government, therefore does not have standing to bring a suit against the U.S.
That holding, Your Honor, is...
lost this case. I'm trying to figure out what's going on.
No. That holding, Your Honor, is intimately related to the second part of the court's decision. Because Mr. Centers was not asserting a claim based on a contractual relationship, but is part two of the court's opinion, which discusses the question and the application of the Assignment Act indicates. Exactly, Your Honor. The key to the court's decision is Mr. Center's allegation in this complaint, which is reproduced in the joint appendix, that what he's suing on is a choice of action. And what the court held, and what we urge affirmance upon, is the fact that the Anti-Assignment Act, the Assignment of Claims Act, excuse me, prohibits assignment of claims as the court held under circumstances such as this. The question of privity in this case is really incidental, because under the Tucker Act, Mr. Senders could bring a party may bring a suit based upon the existence of a contract with the United States.
Okay, well, the assignment can't be made because HUD didn't approve it. What about Insurance Company of the West?
Well, the Insurance Company of the West specifically addresses the question of the assignment of rights under a certain contract to a subrogee. And the Insurance Company of the West specifically cites as an exception provisions such as occurred here, such as the Anti-Assignment Act. This is a case where the provisions of the Anti-Assignment Act, the Assignment of Claims Act, specifically applies. As the Court of Claims, there are three hurdles Mr. Senders has to get over to get around the Assignment of Claims Act in this case. One, as the Court of Federal Claims held, this is the type of case in which the government faces the risk of multiple claimants. And this is the prime example of such a case, because we have multiple claimants in this case. We have Sentinel seeking payment from HUD, when in fact apparently the claim was had been previously transferred to Mr. Senders. The court held under these facts that the cases which previously have recognized exceptions to the Assignment of Claims Act should not be followed in this case, because this case presents such an example. We also have the potential here of the government assuming the additional risk that if such claims against the government could be freely transferred, the government would lose the right to contest assert defenses against the potential assignees. And that's reflected in cases which we've cited in our brief in the statutory language. And there's a third reason, although the Court of Federal Claims didn't address it, and that's the question of whether an exception to the Assignment of Claims Act exists in this case. Now, the Supreme Court has considered the scope of the Assignment of Claims Act, and in United States versus Dow, specifically declined to extend, to recognize as an exception to the Assignment of Claims Act, cases in which there have been voluntary transfers. Now, we're fully aware that in Roe Reeves versus United States, a Court of Federal Claims case decided subsequent to Dow, the court continued to recognize exceptions to the Assignment of Claims Act. In that case, recognized an assignment that appears to be voluntary. Roe Reeves does not discuss application of United States versus Dow. And for that reason, this panel should look as definitive clarification to the current state with regards to exceptions of the Assignment of Claims Act, the Supreme Court statement in United States versus Staff.
Because what you're telling us, Mr. Grock, doesn't really have very much relationship to the opinion of the Court of Federal Claims.
I don't agree, Your Honor, because there are two points. On two of the very points I've discussed, the Court of Federal Claims agreed with us. And that was under the heretofore recognized exceptions to the assignment.
Perhaps in the result, but not in the reasoning.
Now, two of the specific points, Your Honor, which I've urged concerning the Assignment of Claims Act were specifically agreed to and adopted by the Court of Federal Claims. That in this case presents the situation of multiple claimants and that the United States would lose defenses. On those two points, the Court of Federal Claims specifically adopted the reasoning that I'm arguing here. And either of those two arguments are completely dispositive of this appeal. As an additional basis for affirmance, I'm basically raising a third argument which we discussed below. And that is, under United States versus Dow, the Supreme Court has recognized that voluntary transfers are not subject to an exception to the Assignment of Claims Act. The court disagreed with us in that regard or didn't adopt our reasoning. However, this is not anything that requires additional review of the record. And this court may properly affirm on the basis of the record below when the case law supports that affirmance. And in this case, United States versus Dow requires the court to affirm this.
It's like you're arguing against the Court of Federal Claims theory. You wanted to either have done it on a statute of limitations basis or on the basis you just said. You don't like what he said.
Absolutely.
He said privity, didn't he?
He addressed contractual issues regarding privity. But his argument regarding privity...
Are you going to support his argument, or are you going to make your own?
Well, I think in two specific cases, two of the specific holdings of the Court of Federal Claims, either of which specifically requires affirmance of the judgment below. And that is, this case presents an issue of the possibility of multiple claimants. And this case presents the issue of the possibility of the government losing defense. So, in addition to those arguments, we were advancing two additional arguments in support of the judgment below. And because these arguments, this doesn't involve any factual finding, this involves strictly this court's interpretation of the established case law, we think we can properly urge those arguments in affirmance of the judgment below.
How do you distinguish the insurance company of the West as you were asked at the beginning?
That case involves a question of subrogation. Prior decisions of this court and the Court of Federal Claims have expressly required the existence of privity with the United States. And Insurance Company of the West doesn't purport, and indeed as a panel of this court, could not overrule the prior precedent of this court, which specifically requires existence of privity. When the court identified the specific... I see my time is up. The court has identified the specific problem in the question considered in privity. Insurance Company of the West made a broad statement but did not purport to overrule the specific authority upon which we relied and could not as a panel of this court.
So you're saying it's a subrogation case more than
more, in long winded fashion, yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Burke.
Are you going to argue against Mr. Grover or against the Court of Federal Claims?
Well,
it seems like there's you have your choice.
The government's position keeps shifting here. They made the privity argument in front of the court below, and now they seem to back away from it. Insurance Company of the West is our answer, long and short of.
But before Insurance Company of the West, it's always been required that there be privity. That's established by case after case after case. And where is your privity here? Where's the proof of that?
It's only through the assignment, Your Honor. I mean, the facts are undisputed.
Then you have the problem of the Anti-Assignment Act.
Your Honor, on the Anti-Assignment Act, A. Dow has never been read to bar all voluntary transfers. Indeed, the prior Supreme Court decision in Shannon said that an assignment is voluntary is not the end of the matter. In that case, it was cited with approval in Dow. And then you've got Will Reeves not reading it that way.
Is there a difference between subrogation and assignment?
Well, the subrogation occurs normally, as I see it, Your Honor, in a specific context.
By operation of law, doesn't it?
Yes.
Under the contract or otherwise?
Yes.
Subrogation, stand in the shoes of the...
Right. Based on a voluntary insurance contract, normally that's entered into earlier. Whereas an assignment is a voluntary act. But, as we pointed out, the case law on the Anti-Assignment Act has permitted, has recognized assignments as being legitimate, notwithstanding outside the ambit of the Act, when they've been made for legitimate reasons not designed to harass the government. And business restructurings have been recognized, and in this case, the government talks about theoretical possibilities that always exist. There is no allegation that they're going to lose a defense. They say, well, possibly you might, but there is no factual allegation that they've lost anything by Mr. Centers pursuing it instead of Centennial. Multiple claimants. Again, that mischaracterizes the situation. Mr. Centers and Centennial cooperated in terms of seeking the supplemental payment. When HUD declined to make it in response to an administrative request, and it became clear they were going to have to litigate, Centennial was not part of that, and the Seventh Circuit, as the court pointed out, said that they couldn't be required to be part of that. So he's gone forward there. But all that's happened, Mr. Centers has been, since day one, the equitable owner of this claim. And all that the assignment and issue here did was transfer legal title to the party that's always been the equitable owner. It didn't bring in any new players, didn't bring in any new influences. There was no attempt to, if you will, get over on the government, which was the concern that motivated the passage of the Anti-Assignment Act back around the time of the Civil War.
How do you get by this? An assignment may be made only after a claim is allowed, the amount is decided, the warrant for the payment has been issued. a lot of language here. How do you get by all that?
You mean in the act itself?
Yeah, in the act itself.
Because the Supreme Court has said in the dispositive jurisprudence on it, that Aetna case, we believe, that the act has not for a century been construed in accordance with the strict statutory terms. It's been construed in accordance with its purpose. And the courts have been in the business of doing that, including the predecessor to this court.
And one of the purposes would be preventing multiple claims, claims from multiple parties on the same fact. Right?
Well, that's been...
Wouldn't that happen here even?
Well, it's... You could have that in a subrogation case, Your Honor. I mean, there's always the possibility of multiple claimants, but in fact, you have not had, at any point, any competing claims. There have been no competing claims with two different people coming in and saying we're entitled to the same thing. The facts here are directly analogous to National Australia Bank, in which another member of the Court of Federal Claims upheld the assignment, where the parent corporation held on to the claims of the subsidiaries when it sold the subsidiaries. And that was found to be appropriate. And it's less extreme than a case upheld nearly a century, nearly 50 years ago by the predecessor to this court, Mitchell Canneries, where a claim belonged to a corporation. Then it was transferred to a partnership where the two partners were then the principals behind the original corporation. Then they changed and formed a new corporation, and they took it with them to the new corporation. And the court said that was fine. It didn't offend the Anti-Assignment Act because the claim had remained with people that at all points had been the equitable owners of the claim. And that's what you've got here. There was this was not done as a way to leverage on the claim. The assignment here was part of a business restructuring where basically Mr. Centers cashed out its centennials, sold off the business, and held on to various assets, basically all of the assets of the company, including the shows in action. I see that my time's expired. If there are no further questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gordon and Mr. Grove. The case is taken into submission.